Hi, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Saturday, August 8th. In the fireside room this evening is Ralph Milton. Today's session number is 99-5 and it's titled The Roots of Our Hebrew Tradition. Let's listen in.
My name is Ralph Milton. This is Bev Milton, and we are going to deal today with the story of Jacob. Jacob is, like many characters in the Hebrew scriptures, is a most interesting and multifaceted guy. The story of Jacob could make a mini-series on television anytime. It has all the elements of passion and violence and sibling rivalry and
polygamy,
in and out of bed, bad dreams and good dreams, and God. And it's all in there, and it's a marvelous story. But to understand the story of Jacob, you have to go back a little bit to the story of his mother, whose name was
Rebecca.
Now, Rebecca was one substantial lady. I want to read you a story of Rebecca just to start things out. There we go. The story is called 10 Stinking Camels. 10 camels. I should have had my head examined for saying I would water 10 stinking camels. Rebecca was muttering to herself. She'd been up and down the well for almost 2 hours, and the camels were still drinking. She'd been very willing at first. Her upbringing and her good nature had prompted her to volunteer to water this man's camels. He was a stranger in town, so when he asked Rebecca for a drink, she was glad to offer him a water jar. And then she offered to water his camels, too. Finally, the last of the camels raised its head from the water trough, gave her a disdainful look, and turned away. Well, the same to you, Rebecca thought to herself. She'd never really liked camels. They had bad tempers, had terrible body odor, and they always looked disdainful. The man approached her. "Thank you very much," he said. "You are very kind, and you must be very tired. Here, I have something for you." With more gentleness than Rebecca expected, he gave her 2 heavy gold bracelets for her arm and a ring for her nose. "Tell me whose family you belong to, and is there room for me to stay in your house tonight?" "My father's house is Bethuel, and we have plenty of room and lots of food for all 10 camels." Rebecca hadn't really meant to emphasize all 10 that way, but she was relieved when the man chuckled. "They are thirsty beasts, aren't they?" "I'll run ahead and tell my mother you're coming," said Rebecca. Her tired legs found new life in her excitement as she ran down the path to her home. "Mom, Laban, everybody, we're having company. I don't know who he is, but I watered all 10 of his camels, and then he gave me all of this. Look!" And the whole household came running to see Rebecca's expensive gifts. "I told him he could stay here overnight." "Who is he?" her brother Laban demanded. "I don't know. He didn't say. But he's got something in his mind, I can tell." "Did he say what?" Laban looked at his sister intently. Rebecca blushed. "No, but he watched every move I made while I watered all 10 of his camels." "Well, don't stand around. Get the house clean. Start cooking," Laban barked the command and rushed out of the house to find this wealthy stranger. Rebecca often thought about that night, how it had totally changed her life. The man had come to their house, identified himself as Abraham's servant, and told the family that God wanted Rebecca to come to be the wife to Abraham's son Isaac. He knew it was Rebecca that God wanted because she watered all the camels. That was a sign. When Rebecca heard that, she didn't know whether to laugh or cry. So could maybe 2 or 3 camels have been enough sign, she wondered. Laban and Bethuel, her father, just shrugged. "Well, if that's what God wants, that's how it has to be." Nobody bothered to ask Rebecca how she felt about this. The next day, she was on her way. Her family had wanted her to wait a few days to give them all a chance to say goodbye, but Rebecca refused. If I've got to go, I want to go now. Let's not drag this thing out. So across the desert they went, swaying on top of those cranky, smelly camels, day after hot, dreary day. Motion sickness and boredom and heat. That's mostly what Rebecca remembered about the trip. Then, that and a churning stomach as she wondered what this Isaac was like that God wanted her to marry. Did I have a choice, she wondered? No, the answer was clearly no. Women had very few choices. Then God help me make the best of whatever it is to be, she prayed. She first saw Isaac walking across the field toward her. Rebecca got down from her camel, pulled her veil down across her face, and walked toward him. Rebecca saw the embarrassment, the strain in the man's face. He obviously felt he should say something, but he had no idea what, so Isaac turned and walked toward his mother's tent. She followed in silence. There, in a short little ceremony, they were married, before they said their first words to each other. It was a strange marriage, a strange relationship. Isaac clearly wanted Rebecca to be a replacement for his strong and active mother, Sarah, who had died a few years earlier. But Rebecca was herself, and Isaac learned to love her in a dependent, small boy kind of way. She had to watch herself. Appearances were everything, and it was important that Isaac still appear to be the head of the household. God, you called me here, right? Like other desert folk, Rebecca was candid and direct in her conversations with God. You got me married to this man, this weak and indecisive man, who will make nothing of himself unless I do it. I didn't have a lot of options, did I, God? Well, running this household through this man is no harder than watering 10 camels. So if you wanted a weaker woman for this man, why 10 camels? 2 camels would have got you a nice, mousy woman for this man. And Rebecca laughed a little and went about doing what she knew she had to do, making the best of whatever was. Now, how many of you would identify Rebecca as a kind of a patron saint of the person who does what she has to do because that's where she is and there aren't a whole lot of alternatives? I don't want you to put your hands up or anything. I just want you to think about that. Rebecca was a remarkably strong woman who knew who she was, but because of her gender and because of her society, she was simply channeled into places where she found herself, and she didn't have a lot of chances on this. But it's interesting. Isaac was a bit of a wimp. He really didn't do very much or say very much, and his story isn't particularly interesting. But Rebecca's is. Now, Rebecca became pregnant. This does happen when people get married. And she had twins in her womb. She could feel them struggling around inside her and fighting with each other. So she went to consult an oracle, and the oracle told her that these were twins, nations fighting in her womb, and that the secondborn would be the more powerful and would rule over the firstborn, which was, of course, you know, upsetting the way things should be in that culture. Well, they were born. And out first came Esau, with all covered with red hair, and that's why they named him Esau, which means red. And he came out, but grabbing his heel as he came out of the womb was the second one, with no hair at all, and they called him Jacob, which may mean the heel, or the supplanter, or the one who takes what doesn't belong to him. These kids grew up in a good, healthy sibling relationship where they hated each other's guts. Esau was related to his daddy. And Esau was the hunter and went out killing stuff and bringing it back, and that it pleased daddy. Jacob was the mama's boy. And so at one point when they are, you know, already young men, Esau comes home from an unsuccessful hunt. And this would be a hunt that would go on for several weeks, so he might not have eaten for a long time. And he came back home, and there is Jacob stirring a pot of red beans, or lentil stew, probably. And he is stirring this stuff, and Esau comes along and says, "Give me some of that, I'm starving." And Jacob says, "What do you pay me for?" And they dicker back and forth, and finally Jacob gets Esau to promise him that the birthright will be his. Well, okay, he eats the stew, and nothing much more is thought about than that, until a number of years later, when Daddy Isaac is getting old, and pretty blind, and decides that he's not long for this world. So he is getting ready to pass on the inheritance. All right? Let me read you the story.
As you have interpreted.
Oh, yes, as I have interpreted. Oh, yeah, somebody asked me, are these stories, as I tell them, historical? Hysterical, maybe, but not historical. Thank you, Bev, because stories are stories. I am a storyteller. I'm not a theologian, and I'm not a historian. I see these stories as stories, and the truth lies within the story, within the story as you hear it. And what you hear is different from what I think I'm saying. At least half of what's going into your heads is coming out of your own imagination, how you imagine these stories. And so, yes, these are not history. This is one person's interpretation of how this went. Go back and read the Bible yourself. 1 and 2 Samuel, as I said, is a marvelous mini-series. And this is a story that, if I accomplish nothing else, it will be to send you back to read those stories as stories. You need to do that before you start asking questions of history and theology. First, enjoy the story. Then go and dig behind them and ask a lot of questions, but first, enjoy the story. This is my attempt to tell this story to children. So kids, no, don't take the children away. I don't think Esau even remembers what he promised you, Rebecca said one day. But a promise is a promise, said Jacob. Maybe, said Rebecca. But your father Isaac doesn't know about it, and one day he will give Esau his blessing. That means everything he has, all his goats and his sheep and everything, will belong to Esau. Esau will get everything, even though Esau said you would have it. So what do I do? I'm not sure, said Rebecca, but I'm always near your father. He is so old and blind now, I have to take care of him all the time, so I'll look for a chance. One day it happened. Tell Esau I want to talk with him, the old Isaac said to Rebecca. So Rebecca went and called Esau. Then she stood just outside their tent and listened to what Isaac said. Esau, my son, Isaac took Esau's hairy hands into his. I am getting very old. I can't see anymore and I can't walk. I think I'm going to die soon. Before I die, I want to give you my blessing. Oh, now, father, said Esau, you're not going to die. You'll be able to see again. It's all right, said Isaac. I have had a good life, and I am ready to die. Now, go out and hunt something to eat. Bring it back here and make a tasty dinner for me. When I've eaten the food, I'll give you my blessing. Yes, father. Esau ran off to get his bows and arrows, and Rebekah ran off to find Jacob. Listen, Jacob, Rebecca talked very fast. Go get a goat quickly. Kill it so that we can cook it just the way your dad likes it. And here, tie this goat skin on your neck and on your hands so you'll feel as hairy as Esau. Get some of Esau's clothes so you'll smell like him too. Jacob took the food in and he tried to trick his dad. I'm back, Dad, he said, trying to make his voice sound like Esau's. God helped me to catch something very fast, so I cooked it just the way you like it. Old Isaac reached out to touch Jacob as he gave him the food. Your voice sounds like Jacob, Isaac said, but your hands feel like Esau's. Then the old man ate the food. He still wasn't quite sure it was Esau, so he said, come close to me so I can kiss you. When Jacob came close, Isaac could smell Esau's clothes and the clothes of a hunter. Then he thought it was really Esau. So Isaac blessed Jacob, thinking it was Esau. May God give you every good thing, he said. May the promise that God made to your grandparents, Sarah and Abraham, be your promise too. And everything that I own is yours, my son. Soon after Isaac got up and left, Esau came in. Here is the food I have cooked for you, Dad, he said. Who are you? Isaac asked. I am Esau, your eldest son. I have come for your blessing. Isaac started to shake all over. Who was it that just brought me some food? Because whoever it was, I have given him my blessing. It's that Jacob again, yelled Esau. He keeps taking what doesn't belong to him. He cheats me out of everything. Yes, said Isaac. Your brother came in and lied to me, and he took your blessing. Can't you give me a blessing too? Esau asked. He was crying now. Please, Dad, can't you bless me too? No, Esau, I can't. I'm so sorry, but I can't. What I have done, I have done. I can't change it. Esau was very, very angry. I'm going to kill Jacob for what he did, he thought to himself. I'm going to kill him. Rebekah knew how angry Esau was, so she said to Jacob, you have to run away. Go right now. But where can I go, mother? Asked Jacob. Go to my brother Laban, who lives in Haran. Go stay with him until Esau stops being angry. Then you can come back home. So Jacob ran away to Haran. Jacob had cheated his brother. Now his father was very sad. His brother was very angry. His mother had told him to run away. He wouldn't get his father's sheep and goats and the blessing after all. Jacob wasn't very happy. And Rebekah cried because Jacob wasn't at home anymore. Now, do you remember the rest of the story? Jacob is on the lam. He's running. And after a full day of running, he falls exhausted at a place, and he has a dream. You know the song that came out of that dream? We are climbing Jacob's ladder. It wasn't a ladder. It was probably a stairway or something like that. And it was probably like those ziggurats that the Babylonians built, that sort of thing. And Jacob wasn't climbing. God and the angels came down to him. So the song is basically all haywire. But Jacob has the dream, the same dream that had been had by his father and his grandfather before them, the dream of God promising to make a nation out of him, that his descendants would be as many as the stars in the sky and the sand on the seashore. This promise, the idea of promise, is the theme that flows through all those early books, chapters of Genesis, the promise that is being carried forward, and the promise that is invested in such unlikely characters such as Jacob, who was, as his name implied, a cheater. He cheated his brother, lied to his father, and now he was on the run. And he has this dream that God is going to make of him a nation. And he sets up a stone and pours some oil on it and calls the place Bethel. Yes, a house of God. Bethel. And then he goes wandering on his way, trying to find his uncle Laban. Like, he'd never been there before, so he didn't really know the way. And eventually he comes across a group of shepherds, and he says, do you know where Haran is and where my uncle Laban lives? Oh yes, we know your uncle Laban. In fact, here comes his daughter. Rachel with some sheep. Now, he had been talking to the shepherds about the fact that the well was closed over with a large stone. And the shepherd said, we wait until everybody is here, so we all grab the stone together and lift it off, and then we water our sheep. Jacob sees Rachel coming up and does the macho thing. He grabs that stone and he heaves it off, probably has a hernia in the process, and then runs over and gets Rachel to water her sheep, and he kisses her and he cries on her shoulder. And I would imagine that poor Rachel didn't know what was really going on. I mean, can you imagine some stranger coming out of like that? Anyway, eventually, he gets himself invited to Uncle Laban. And sure enough, in Uncle Laban, Jacob meets his match. Yes. Uncle Laban finally decides, he sees it very right away, that Jacob wants to, you know, he's got the hots for Rachel. And he makes a deal with him that Jacob will work for 7 years as a bride price for Rachel. And those 7 years, it says, just went by like nothing. No problem at all. And then when the 7 years were over, Jacob says to Laban, okay, I've done my work, now give me my bride. And so Laban throws a big party, and Jacob has a good time and drinks probably a whole lot more wine than he should. And then, read the story then.
I will never forget Jacob's eyes. It had been a joyous night for me. Murmurs, gentle touch, contented sleep. His arm resting quietly under my head. His breath soft on my veiled cheek. Just as the morning light brought its glow into our tent, Jacob woke and looked at me. I saw tenderness and love in his dark eyes. Then he lifted up my veil, and the look of love turned to disgust and anger. What the blazes, Jacob yelled, what are you doing here? I knew it would be like this. I told my father Laban that it wouldn't work. Jacob would despise me. He wouldn't listen. It's your only chance, Laban said. You're no spring chicken, Leah. And you have those god-awful eyes. And if I didn't get you married to Jacob, you'd be an old maid. An old maid, Leah, who nobody wants and nobody cares about. No, I said, it's not right. Leah, said Laban, I'm your father and I have decided. You will wear a heavy veil, and I'll keep your sister Rachel hidden away, and we'll marry you off to Jacob. After a few glasses of wine, he won't know the difference. You have no say in the matter. Now shut up and do what you're told. I did as I was told. A woman, especially an ugly woman, has no rights. Still, I couldn't help feeling like a piece of slightly tainted meat my father was trying to sell to unsuspecting buyers. But somehow, as father worked on the plan to trick Jacob, I began to fantasize that maybe Jacob might love me after all. Maybe the wedding night would be a night of love, and he might at least not despise me. It was silly, of course, and I don't have much to live on except my fantasies. Jacob stormed out of the tent that morning, as I guess I knew he would. I could hear snippets of angry arguments from Father's tent most of the next day. In the end, my father agreed that Jacob would marry Rachel too. but he'd have to work another 7 years to pay for her. Just as he'd already worked 7 years to pay for me. The ugly bride he didn't want. I tried to be a good wife. When Jacob came into my tent to do his duty as a husband, I tried so hard to be kind, to be gentle, to be loving. But I knew he never came to me in love. I would have died, I think, except for God. I talked to God a lot. I cried a lot at night, and in the tears I found some comfort. I complained about my eyes, grumbled a lot about my lot in life, and prayed that I would have the babies Jacob wanted. And they came, my little blessings, beautiful boys. I thought that would make Jacob love me, but it didn't work. Maybe that's why I made those snooty remarks to my pretty younger sister. It was the only time in our whole lives when I had something and she didn't. It took some years, some tears, and much prayer before I finally told Rachel I was sorry. I'm glad we're friends again. I was with her when she finally had a baby, little Joseph. But she was older now, and older women had a hard time having babies. And when Benjamin was born, well, Rachel gave her life to have that baby. It broke my heart to lose my sister, and it broke Jacob's heart to lose the woman he had loved so deeply and so long. One night, Jacob came to my bed again. But instead, we talked and talked and cried and laughed a little as we shared our grief. And for a little while at least, I knew that in a different kind of way, he loved me too. And so I am content. I have my children. And Jacob has become, if not the husband who loves me, then at least a friend. And I talk to God a lot. I am content.
The story of Rachel and Leah is a classic story. You may have heard of Jung's archetypes and his the collective unconscious, the stories that he says flow through all cultures and all peoples. And this is the classic story of the ugly older sister and the beautiful younger sister. That story, the Cinderella story, many other stories in Joseph Campbell, the mythologist, talks about this theme as it finds its way through all literature. And this is one of those classic stories of the ugly older woman and the beautiful younger woman and the conflict between them. Well, to carry on the story, Jacob works for another 7 years. And he and Laban get into a wonderful kind of a dickering thing. Jacob says, look, Laban, for my work here, I'll take just the sheep that are striped and spotted. Sheep and goats that are striped and spotted. And Laban says, all right. So he has his other sons go through and take out all the spotted sheep and stuff like that. But Jacob is smart. It may be that Rachel or Leah helped them with it, but they strip the bark off some particular kind of trees and hold them up or put them up there where the sheep are mating at the water trough. And sure enough, all the offspring of those sheep are spotted and striped. And after a while, Jacob turns out to be a very wealthy person. Everything is going well for him. Now, this is another theme here. The younger son who seems to have everything open up to him in spite of the fact that he does everything wrong. That youngest child theme is another one of those themes that goes through world literature and many peoples. This is why these stories have such lasting power, is because they speak to something deep inside ourselves. So, Jacob manages to outdo Uncle Laban. And then one day, he takes the whole raft and he has a message from God that he's supposed to go and get himself reconciled to Esau. So while Laban is out shearing the sheep somewhere, he takes his whole household, which numbers quite a few folks now and a lot of livestock, and they head out. Well, Laban, of course, is fit to be tied, and he chases after them. And he finally catches up to them and says, you know, what are you doing here? And what's more, how dare you steal my household gods? These were small images that they kept and they worshipped and fed and all those kinds of things. What Jacob didn't know was that Rachel had gone and taken all of Laban's household gods. Now, here is a bit of really subtle humor in this story, because when Laban catches up to them and, you know, mentions this business of the household god, Jacob says, hey, we didn't take it. You just search any place around here. You can search the whole bunch, and if you find those household gods with anybody, I'll execute them right on the spot. Rachel has them in her saddlebag, and she sits down on the saddlebag and sits there, and Frederick Buechner says that these household gods are poking her backside, so she really is bleeding. But when Laban comes in, she says, please excuse me, I can't stand up. It is with me as with the way of women. And so Laban doesn't find those household gods. Now there's a wonderful joke in there, because a woman in her menstrual period was considered absolutely unclean, and she's sitting on Laban's gods. Now there is a joke within there. The storyteller is having a joke at the expense of Laban. They make an agreement, basically they declare a truce, and they put up a bunch of stones, and Laban says, I'll stay on that side if you stay on that side. And so that's the way it works. And they move along, and then they have to start confronting the problem of Esau. Because Esau hasn't been sitting at home twiddling his thumbs either. They are probably aware that he has become a fairly powerful and rich person. And Jacob is not at all comfortable about how he's going to reconcile himself with his brother. And at one point, they come to the river Jabbok, and Jacob sends all his wives and helpers and slaves and the livestock to the other side of the Jabbok. Why? He says, I need to be here by myself to get my head straight for a while. And there becomes, at that point, happens a crucial incident in the history of the Hebrew people. Jacob knew it would be a restless night. He was given to dreams, to nights of tossing and turning, and waking in the morning, not knowing whether it was a dream or a vision or a nightmare or hallucination or simply too much spice on the meat or too much wine to drink. And Jacob knew that God would speak to him through dreams or visions or whatever it was that happened during those long and restless nights. Especially when things were falling apart in his life, especially when he was afraid. And Jacob was afraid for his life. But it was getting dark, and tomorrow would be a hard day, and somehow he just had to get some rest. There was Esau, his angry brother, to face tomorrow. Jacob was on his way back because, well, God had told him in one of those dreams or visions or whatever to go back home. Home, Where is home? He had left his mother's house 15 years before, running for his life. Jacob had cheated his brother out of the family inheritance. When Esau threatened to kill him, Jacob ran before he could collect the inheritance, ran off to some distant relatives in the country called Haran. There he managed, through hard work and a fair bit of cheating, to acquire two wives, a bunch of kids, a bundle of servants, and who knows how many sheep and goats and camels. He'd come to Haran with nothing but the shirt on his back. Now he was a wealthy man, but he couldn't go back to Haran either, because he had also swindled his uncle Laban. Where can I go? Jacob demanded. My brother Esau and my uncle Laban are both angry enough to kill me. Go home, said God. Jacob's stomach churned. His head ached. I've got to get some rest, he muttered to himself, as he laid a blanket over the sharp rocks and prickly bushes of the unrelenting desert. The last rays of sun faded from the cloudless sky as Jacob dozed a little, fitfully. Finally, he fell into a troubled sleep. Then into his sleep or vision came a stranger, a man, a someone. And Jacob wrestled with the man, wrestled and struggled hour after hour, straining for every small advantage, every muscle, every sinew stressed. And then the stranger reached and pressed, and Jacob screamed as waves of pain shot from his hip throughout his body. But Jacob held on with every fiber, held on, knowing somehow beyond knowing that this was a struggle for life itself, knowing that this wrestling was a battle for his very soul. Let me go, said the stranger. It will soon be dawn. Dawn, I have to go. Bless me, Jacob screamed. Bless me. Something changed just then. Jacob sensed that now the stranger's death grip changed to an embrace. What is your name? The voice was gentle. My name is Jacob. What does your name mean? It means I am a cheater. I take what isn't mine. Now, Jacob, now you have a new name. Your name is Israel. Israel, the one who wrestles with God, the one who knows God in the stress of life. And not your name only, but the name of all your children, all God's children through the ages, shall be known as Israel, the people who struggle with God. Jacob stood to meet the dawn and screamed with pain. His hip was out of joint, and Jacob knew that whether it was a dream or a vision, he had indeed struggled with God, struggled with himself, and from the struggle, God was calling him toward a way of being he could hardly understand, much less explain. Jacob faced the rising sun and faced the pain that throbbed his new name, Israel, hard into his mind. Israel, the wounded people who struggle with their God. Then Jacob, Israel, walked limping to his future. Jacob is reconciled to Esau. He finds out in the end that Esau does not bear a grudge, and the two brothers embrace, but probably quite wisely decide not to live in the same area. And then Jacob, his 12 sons and one daughter, Dinah, or Dinah apparently, as it's properly pronounced, and that the story of Dinah is one of those stories I'm not going to get into, but it's not a happy story. They become the founding family that moves into the next generation, and once again, it is not the eldest son that inherits. It's not the youngest son either. It is Joseph. And Joseph goes to Egypt, and the story continues, and it gets even more wonderful as it goes along. Now, talk to me a little bit, feedback some thoughts, concerns, annoyances, quibbles, reflections.
The first reflection is, well, gosh, those women had it tough in those days.
Yeah.
It's bad enough now that they had a somewhat masculine world, but holy smokes, back then he said, hey, you come here, you know? That was that.
Yeah, they really had very little choice.
One step up from cattle.
Yes, only slightly more valuable than cattle, yes. And that continued, that continued right through until, well, almost modern times. When my mother was born in Canada, she was not legally a person under the law. It wasn't until about 4 years before I was born that she became legally a person. The Constitution of Canada did not refer to men, and they had to go all the way up through the courts and so forth to prove that the phrase men also included women. You see? And so up until that time, she could not vote, she could not hold office, she couldn't own property, she wasn't a person. You see? Yeah.
Well, and yeah, to take issue with that, if you look in particular at Rebecca, Rebecca was the one that really changed the destiny, or followed, as we now say, followed God's command. She was the instrument of God there, not Isaac.
Right, absolutely. And what she and so many of the matriarchs of the Bible and in other, they realized they worked within what they had. They worked with what they had, and they very often became the power behind the throne, or, you know, the old saying, slightly sexist saying, that behind every successful man there stands a surprised woman. I think the original was there stands a very capable woman. But yes, the other day we were talking about the film of Churchill's mother, Winston Churchill's mother, and how she exercised power from behind the scenes. You see, so Rebecca and all of the other strong matriarchs, Deborah, Leah for that matter, and Rachel, they were not powerless. They were disempowered by the structure of the society, but they were able to prevail.
But in that, the other two women, that you have, left out there, the mothers of his other sons, besides
the two slave women. Yes, yes.
Their relationship to that.
Yes, right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, their relationship there, it's a very interesting custom through which they were called harem, or at least it was quite customary to bear children through your slave women. And, but certainly they wouldn't have had any choice in the matter.
But
am I responding to your concern, Heidi?
I think you addressed it.
Uh-huh. Yeah?
But the Rachel would offer her slave, which is done earlier.
Sure, yes.
So that there would be a child that says something about her understanding of her role.
It's the same way that Sarah gave birth, got Hagar to give birth to Ishmael. On her knee and so forth, so that was a way for a woman who was not having children some other way to have these children. And of course, if the woman was barren, it was always the woman that was to blame. Yeah?
Well, just a question in general. If the Hebrew society at that time is generally patriarchal, how do these stories about strong women survive the oral tradition and get written down? What drives this society to record the strength of so many women in that society? And I don't know if it's an unintelligent question or not, but it just seems to me that it's interesting to hear that society, early society, condemned for being so patriarchal. We see so many stories of good, strong, faithful women.
I don't condemn the Hebrew society for being patriarchal, because every society pretty well was, and it was, you know, our society still is to a large extent. I mean, that's not anything unique to the Hebrew society. Why? Well, of course, it wasn't until the beginning of the feminist movement that we began to look at some of these stories of women and pick them out and say, hey, who was this? You know, and to notice that there were strong women in the Bible. Just to notice that. There's a lot of strong women whose names aren't even there, which is really sad. Ask Heidi about that. She can tell you a lot. Do you want to say anything more about that?
About women who don't even have names. Well, I can't think of any right now, but it's true. In a text I talked about today, the Five Books of Miriam, Ellen Frankel, who is a feminist scholar, has pulled out a number of those women and actually found names for them. And in fact, actually, the rabbis did give names. For instance, to Noah's wife, mm-hmm. who is unnamed, to Potiphar's wife, who is unnamed. There are a number of women like that who were later the rabbis, actually. So you're right. I mean, it comes. The rabbis did continue to discuss these women and give them names and try to consider why they did or what role they had.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You would say something?
What did this Jacob story do for the Hebrew people? Did it tell them who they are? Did it help them with identity? What do you do for that?
Joel, respond to that.
I don't have an easy answer for that. I mean, I would say that part of the identity of the Jewish people is with the name Israel, a group that struggles with God. And we still kind of talk about it the same way, because in Judaism there's still a struggle with God,
yes.
and what God is all about. At least we say, well, at least it's us.
Yeah.
You know, that's part of what we do.
One of the things that I've always enjoyed about the Hebrew tradition is their ability to talk directly to God, to bargain with God, and to tell God when God's wrong. You know, this is, we have in our Christian society sort of we walk on eggshells, and we only talk to God when we're on our knees. How many of you have seen the movie Fiddler on the Roof? You remember old Tevye walking along and shaking his finger at God and arguing with God and quoting the scripture at God and stuff like that? A marvelous presentation of that attitude that God can be addressed with openness and clarity and force, and that it's okay to disagree about that stuff. Were you going to say something up there? No. Okay. Yes.
I would say, in addition to that, it's also a reconfirmation of the promise.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The whole theme that goes through these early books, the story of Genesis, is the children of the promise and how the promise is fulfilled, and how God helps that promise to be fulfilled through these unlikely persons that populate that book.
So in many societies throughout the world I've seen it, while the men are great patriarchs and that sort of stuff at the city gate and at the courthouse, when they get inside their house, it's a patriarchal society.
It may be, but not in every case.
No, but I mean, in India it is for sure. I mean, brides and burkas, they don't like the guy, you know, and they're treated as second-class citizens, but it's the oldest woman who's the head of that house, head of that family. Mm-hmm. The same thing in Arabia and other places where women are looked down on so far. The women that I've heard talk about going inside the house, who's the boss inside the house? The wife, not the man.
I'd like some...
The last proverb.
Pardon me?
The good woman. The last proverb.
Yeah, exactly. But how do you feel about that, women? Respond to him.
Yeah. I'd really rather vote.
You didn't have the vote.
I'd really rather vote than be the head of any household. Thanks.
Yeah?
We lived in Turkey for a while. We found that in that area, when a man had several wives, there was a lot of mystery and intrigue between the women themselves trying to opt for the place for their son to become the head of the house. And so even between the women, there was a lot of stuff going on.
Were there?
I was at a global mission event a few weeks ago and heard a speaker who was going to be here this week speak. speaking about what's going on in the church in Russia.
Mm-hmm.
And what it is the Lutheran Church in Russia is opening doors of multi-generational church houses in southern Russia that are led by women.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a phenomenally intricate and complex process, but multi-generation of church houses survived in communist Russia for 50 years, led by women.
I'd like to tell you about a women's movement that comes from the 13th and 14th century. It's called the Beguines. Now, in Northern Europe, well, as many other places, but there were the career options for women were rather limited. You had the primary choice, of course, was to be married and have children. If your husband died, you were expected, especially if you had money, to marry again. Another career option was the convent, which was there for you if you had money, because the convent demanded a dowry as well. Ordinary people in the lower classes, the majority of folks had no access to convents, or the monasteries for that matter. The third option was prostitution. There were a few women that were able to maintain a living through various crafts and trades, but they were a very small minority. So there arose a group of women called the Beguines. They lived quite often in groups that they called a convent, but they did not have, as the convents had, a rule that it was approved by the Pope. In fact, there was no external authority whatever. They simply came together so that they could support each other, and they worked in hospitals and various other places, mostly caring for the poor. They could leave the Beguines without shame, no problem. They could, if they had money or estate or property, they kept owning that. And it became a place for these women, because that was just a very necessary thing. But because they were not under the control of Rome and the church authorities, they got stomped on. And they basically, within 100 years, they were all gone. There is still one community of Beguines in Belgium, a very small one, but it's hardly significant. But it was those kinds of resources that people had to muster, women had to muster in order to survive. They were strong women, and out of that group came some marvelous mystics that wrote evocative and powerful literature. Julian of Norwich, that I was talking about last week, was one of them, whose theology is ahead of this time, much less that time. She's ahead of all of us.
So what's the point?
What's the point?
As I'm sitting here thinking, are we talking about what God has in mind for the fulfillment of each individual, for a people? Are we talking about how wonderful it is when women get a fair share?
I'm not talking about... My reason for doing this is not any of those things at all. It is simply to get you so interested that you'll go back and read that story and learn to love it and let it speak to your lives. That's what I want. I'm not here to tell you the what should happen or what you should think or what you should believe, because I have a hard enough time with my own head, much less trying to invade yours. But I really do believe that these stories, if you let yourself get inside them and let them get it in, and listen to those characters, all of them, of Jacob and Laban and Isaac and Abraham and Joseph and his brothers, all of those, that guy, get yourself into those stories, and then retell them in your own words, and you'll find that the story tells you. In the process, you'll find out things about yourself and your relationship to God. Stories are a way of getting at behind the facade of logic. We think in at least two different modes. There is the logical side, or the, let's call it the rational side, and the non-rational side, or should it?
Yes.
Anyway, okay. Roughly corresponding to your, the non-rational to your right brain and the rational to your left brain. But nevertheless, there's rational and there's non-rational. Rational thinking is the kind of thinking that looks at facts and studies them and works through them and arrives at conclusions. And hey, this is an absolutely necessary thing. None of us would be here if it weren't for that kind of invention of automobiles and boats and things and electric lights and all of the great stuff that technology and so forth has brought us. The non-rational side is another complementary way of thinking. It is a way of thinking about the imaginative, the evocative, the beautiful, the depressing, those kinds of parts of our life that do not submit to this kind of rational stuff. A good example that I've often used is a rainbow. If you see a rainbow in the sky, you can look at that and you can say the rainbow is formed by the particles, the refraction of light in the particles of water, and thus splitting the light into its spectrum, and that's how we get a rainbow. That's a rational way of explaining a rainbow, and it's perfectly correct. You can also go to that rainbow and say, wow, that is beautiful. That's just, and you know, it makes me think of the covenant that God has made with humanity. You know, that's a non-rational approach to rainbows. Both are right. One does not contradict the other. They are different ways of approaching reality. And what I'm suggesting is that one of the ways to mine the Bible for its truth and its beauty is to get yourself inside those stories, to tell them in your own words, out of your own life. Listen to yourself telling the stories, and you will learn about, as Tevye says, who you are and what God expects you to do. We have time for one question or comment or statement or something. No?
Sometimes I think that the stories in the first five books, here in Genesis in particular, but there, what was written down was the exception to the rule rather than the rule, like, you know, the youngest brother. And,
yeah.
You know, but it's still, somehow or another, by telling the exceptions to the rule, it, you know, told us what the way humans expect it to be.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's a little, you know, these interventions that happen in, mm-hmm. in the life of the Jewish
yeah.
people that that tell us the way we expect it to be is not God's way. I mean, that's, or at least how it happens.
And the people we would choose are not necessarily the ones that God would choose.
Mm-hmm.
Including ourselves.
Including ourselves.
When I respond to this story, to get maybe what Bev was asking a while ago too, is I see it as a wonderful testimony to that God uses the totality of who we are whenever God chooses, whether it's Rebecca or Rachel or Jacob, it's both the scoundrel and the virtue, every bit, and they're very real characters, which makes me, it gives me some solace, because I don't fit the superhero portfolio for following God too.
No, neither do I. But it, as you're right, it gives me comfort that if God can choose people like Jacob, through which the promise can be carried, then maybe I too can be a bearer of that promise in some way.
Right.
And by golly, that's not bad. Okay, last comment.
Well, one other thing is, I know the Bible is supposed to be the inerrant word of God, and now you're playing around with it and adding stuff to it. Is there any feeling of guilt or any feeling of maybe this isn't the right thing to do?
The idea that the Bible is the words of God as opposed to the Word of God is a very recent invention, and I think it misses the point.
That's what is your comment.
Yes, I know. We could talk about that for a while. But there is a difference between the Word of God and the words of God.
Gotcha.
And the Word of God comes to us through those stories. Yes.
Are you saying stories then in Campbell's myth definition?
Campbell Smith.
Joseph Campbell's myth.
Yeah. Well, okay, a myth. A myth is a story that carries a very deep and fundamental meaning. The popular use of the word myth is something that's not true. But when you use the word myth in the sociological sense, like Joseph Campbell does, it is a powerful story that carries a meaning about something. And so, yes, in that sense, the Bible is myth, which doesn't say whether it's history or not. That has nothing to do with it. Just for instance, as the Martin Luther King is an American myth. He was a historical figure. I've seen the man. I mean, he did exist, and there are facts we can know about him. But as the time goes on, there is a meaning, a significance to his life and what he did that is important to people. There is a myth attached to it. And that's what I'm talking about when I say myth. And in that sense, yes, the Bible is myth. And we should honor it as such.
But the Word of God.
End. The end of the tape.
The words of God are in Hebrew and Greek. They have no idea what they said. Only if they go on some translation, something to change them around.
I know. Okay, thank you.